Okay, I'm just going to present what I think of as some introductory kinds of concepts and things that I think are absolutely crucial. Much of what I'll be speaking about, some of it will be very different for you, and some of it will sound strange. When it sounds particularly strange, I'll point it out. That's so you don't think I don't know that I might be getting a little weird. All right? I'll be doing some demonstrations and things like that as well. A lot of it will be about energy. A lot of it will be about ways of applying the kinds of things that we think about as spiritual consciousness and higher awareness. An emphasis on leaving here with something that you can absolutely use, work on. Working on these principles and much of what I'm going to be saying here in this program, it's very important to understand that it's just not a lot of theory to me. I write about it. These are things I think about all the time. These ideas and these concepts and the application of them, I work on wherever I go, whether I'm driving my car on the freeway or whether I'm in a grocery store or picking up my children from school or any of the hundreds and thousands of things that each and every one of us do every day, I work at it. And how can I apply these principles? How can I live a problem-free life? How can I live at a higher level of consciousness? How can I be more connected to God? How can I practice and live this way in all of the events of my life? Basically, this program is about a spiritual solution to every problem. And there's a line in A Course in Miracles that was very relevant to me. When I sat down to write this book, it's the very first time that I did it without an outline at all. I started chapter one not knowing what was going to be in chapter two or any place down the line. And it was a practice in surrendering, a practice in letting go. I talk about it. I give advice on it. I give speeches about it. I talk on the media about it. And I really decided that I would just see if I could surrender and allow this higher awareness, allow God to work through me by connecting to my source in a way that I had never done before, in a very trusting way. And I just began writing. And one of the things I like to do with an audience is to ask everyone in the room here, if you will just for a second, just point to yourself. Everybody, just point to yourself and look around the room. There's several hundred people here, and notice that no one is pointing to their head. No one is doing this. That we are not our thoughts. When we point to ourselves, we generally point right here to the heart. I have a quote from one of the most important and profound teachers in my life. His name was Francesco, St. Francis of Assisi. Much of the spiritual solution to every problem is based upon his powerful prayer. Much of what you'll hear here in this program is about applying the great wisdom of being an instrument of thy peace. Where there is hatred, bringing love. Because the presence of love in the face of hatred nullifies and dissipates hatred. So the spiritual solution to hatred is just to confront it with love. And it can't survive. Where there is injury, pardon. Injury can't survive in the face of pardon. Where there is doubt, faith. Where there is despair, hope. Where there is darkness, light. You don't have to announce to a dark room, watch out, I'm going to light a candle. You better get out of here, darkness. Darkness simply can't survive in the face of a lit candle of light. Bringing light to darkness is a way of nullifying virtually any problem, where there is sadness, joy. And each of these are chapters in a book, and each of them I'll be talking about here later on. St. Francis, as you'll hear, was a very, very important teacher in my life. I just returned from Assisi last week, and I'll share with you about that and how powerful an experience that was for me. And I was giving a talk in New Orleans just a few weeks ago. and talking a bit about St. Francis and the consciousness that he represented in his lifetime in the 13th century. He was the first confirmed stigmatic. The last 2 years of his life, his hands and his feet and his side had to be bound so that he didn't bleed to death with the wounds of Christ. And when St. Francis died, 2 years later, he was named a saint by the Catholic Church. They said that at his funeral that all of the birds in the forest came to a halt and lined up. He gave sermons to the birds, and all of the animals who were his friends wept. He was, in his own lifetime, recognized for the saintliness that his life represented. Here's what he said. He said, "The mind does nothing but talk and ask questions and search for meanings. The heart does not talk, does not ask questions, does not search for meanings. It silently, silently, it moves towards God and surrenders itself to Him. The mind is Satan's lawyer." I like that. "The heart is God's servant." And I think that when I was writing, I decided that I wouldn't write with a machine, because somehow the machine interfered with this, where you pointed to yourself when you pointed at your heart. I would get up every morning about 3:30, just automatically I would just wake up. And when I get into a writing frenzy, which means once I start a book, I know that I'm going to write every day until it's finished. I never give myself permission to take a day of not writing, because it's like a connection. And I would go over to my office in the middle of the night, about 4 miles from my home. And I would sit down at the dining room table, and I had all these papers all spread out, and I have sort of a funny little routine that I do. If I start writing something and I'd wrinkle up the paper, you know, and throw it, I don't move that until the book is done. And I don't let anybody come into my office and clean anything up or move anything. Whatever is there, it just sits. It's like an energy. Even that which isn't working in the moment becomes something that you rely upon and you notice and you observe. And it's like creating a whole energy field of completion. And when I would sit down, I would put my left hand on the table and take a pad of paper and a ballpoint pen, and then I would allow the words to come through my heart, right through my heart and onto the page. Like I was making this connection between the page, my heart, and what was going to be put on it. So that I would allow my heart, which is who I am, it's just my connection to my source, it's the life beat, if you will, to write. And it's really a surrendering process, and I'm going to talk about that a little bit later. But this whole idea of just letting go, just turning it over, trusting. The most marvelous, most wonderful, the most blissful moments that I can think of in the last couple of years in my life took place while I was doing this writing. In the middle of the night, no one was around, no noises, all the silence, the beautiful silence, the connection, if you will, to God. And I would write every day, and I'd sit down and I'd say, "I wonder what chapter 2 is going to be." And I would just get very quiet and I would listen. It would be just so crystal clear to me, and then that would come on, I would meditate on it. But I suggest that you can do this in any area of your life. When you get to a place of complete trust and surrender, where you can say, "Okay, I'm not alone here, and I'm going to allow this higher voice, this higher self, if you will, to work with me. I'm going to work with it instead of fighting it." And you sort of suspend the ego. And you almost get to a point where you watch yourself. I could see myself sitting there doing what I was doing. And if I would get thirsty, I'd notice that I was getting thirsty. When I was speaking in New Orleans about St. Francis and referring to the way that he would talk about his body, he referred to it always in the third person. "It's tired." It's cold. It's hungry. But I'm not. Who I am is just noticing that. And the more I notice it and the more I allow it to be cold and to be hungry and to be tired, the closer I am to God. This is how he felt. So that his body was really sort of his test about how connected he could be to this higher place. And at the end of the talk, a woman came up to me from, this was a national convention for people who worked in the home care industry, who took care of, came into the homes of people where people were in comas or people were close to death or people had had injuries or had some kind of illnesses and so on, and they would take care of people in their homes. They're servants. And a woman came up to me and she said, I've been reading this book, and it's written by Nikos Kostantzakis. Do you know who that is, any of you? Nikos Kostantzakis? What did he write? Zorba. If you haven't read Zorba, I mean, Zorba comes alive in everything. If you want to know what self-actualization is in the sense of just enjoying life, just read every page of Zorba the Greek, or the Greek Passion, or the Last Temptation of Christ. And he wrote a historical novel called St. Francis in 1962, which is now out of print. And I found very, very, very difficult to get a hold of. In fact, my friend at Hay House, Reed Tracy, got on the internet and said, Wayne, he said, I can get you one copy in hardcover for $125. The orphan in me immediately surfaced. And I said, $125? He said, we're going to get it for you. And they presented it to me as a gift. It's an original first edition of this novel called St. Francis. And this woman was reading a paperback version of it that had the price on it. It was $1.95. So it tells you how old, okay. And she had bought it in a used bookstore for 99 cents. And the pages were all yellow. She said, this is the most glorious book that I have ever read. She said, I have never felt so much just happiness in reading a book. It just seems to come out of every page. The New York Times called Kostantzakis the greatest novelist of the 20th century. So he has some pretty fine credentials. She said, I'm two-thirds of the way through it. And I said, oh, I said, boy, I'm going to Assisi on October the 4th, which is the feast day of St. Francis, who is the patron saint of every animal and every person who's ever suffered, and was leaving on the 4th for Assisi and Lourdes in the south of France. And she said, I want you to have this book. And I said, well, you mean when you finish it? She said, no, I want you to have it now. I said, but it means so much to you. She said, that's what reading this book has taught me. And she handed me the book. And I sold it. No, I didn't sell it. I'm just kidding. Just kidding. And I took that book, and it was like a treasure. This little yellowed $1.95 Ballantine book published back 40-some years ago. And I started reading it, and I realized why he is called the greatest novelist of the 20th century by the New York Times. Because St. Francis came alive, it was written through Brother Leo, who was his constant companion. And it really is one of those books. I don't know if you've had a book that you would read, and it's 467 pages of very small print. And it's one of those books that when you're reading it, you just don't want it to end. So you almost don't want to read it because you know you're going to get closer to the end and then it's going to be over. You ever have a book like that? did I write any of those? No. And so what I have done with A Spiritual Solution to Every Problem is had this saintly little man who really rejected all the formalized practices of the Catholic Church back in the 13th century, all the indulgences and all of the wealth and so on, because his very simple message was one of he had a marriage ceremony in which he married poverty and gave up all his worldly goods. If you ever want to see this, a wonderful, I think the best movie ever made, go look at Franco Zeffirelli's movie in 1975. You can rent it. It's called Brother, Son, Sister, Moon. And, but first, see if you can get a hold of a copy of St. Francis and just immerse yourself in the power of the awareness that there's a spiritual solution to every problem when you begin to understand energy and you begin to understand spirit and how you can bring it to the presence of these things that we call problems, which, as you'll find out, I think are just illusions. The line that I was going to use from A Course in Miracles says this: you have no problems. You only think you do. It's a very powerful and important line. It's something I'd like you to keep in mind as you go through this entire program with me. You have no problems. You only think you do. But before I get into that, which is basically what I want to talk about, I'd like to share with you what it took for me and many of you who have followed my work, my writing over the last 25 years or so, have probably seen a change in emphasis, to put it mildly. At that time, I was writing and talking about the ability to manage your own emotions and to take responsibility for your life and to rid yourself of these things called errors or erroneous zones. Some of you took that book home in brown paper bags, thinking you had a sex book. I remember in 1976, when Erroneous Zones was really hot in the country and on the bestseller list and all of that, and I was invited to come to Houston to give a talk. And the man who introduced me said, last night I saw my wife reading Dr. Dyer's book in bed, and I just looked in the bedroom and I glanced at the title and I thought, this is going to be a pretty good evening. He said, I went about the house and I turned off all the lights and came into the bedroom, got undressed, put on some deodorant, brushed my teeth, even shaved. He said, I got into bed and she started talking to me about my attitude. He said, it wasn't what I had in mind at all. And the earlier works in my life, my professional life, if you will, my publishing life, have sort of reflected a migration through the various archetypes that Carl Jung talked about in his wonderful, wonderful book, Modern Man in Search of a Soul, which I have read at least 10 or 15 times in my life in the last 20 years. When he discussed the archetypes that we go through in our lives, and I've written about these in a book called Manifest Your Destiny. The lowest archetype he called the archetype of the athlete, which is the time in our adult life when our primary emphasis is on our body, what it can do, how strong it is, how beautiful it is, what it looks like, how much it can lift, how fast it can run. He said, then if you're moving and growing, you move to what he called the archetype of the warrior, which is the time in our adult life when our emphasis shifts onto what warriors do, which is they take their bodies, their physical beings, and they go out into the world to conquer, to defeat, to collect, to compete with, to win, to set goals, to get as much as they possibly can. And it's that time in our adult life when our primary emphasis is on getting ahead and saving for the future and evaluating ourselves on the basis of who I'm better than, how much I have. He said, if you're growing, you will move past that archetype into the archetype of the statesman or the stateswoman, which is the time in our adult life when our primary emphasis shifts. And instead of asking what are my quotas and what's in it for me, which is what we do when we're an athlete or a warrior, We begin to ask, what are your quotas? And how may I serve becomes much more important than what's in it for me. And we begin to shift and put our emphasis on serving others, helping others. I remember my introduction into that time in my life was made by my wife when we had two small children. This isn't anything I'm particularly proud of, but it's the truth. And we were flying to Hawaii, I believe, from the East Coast of the United States. It was a long flight. And the flight attendant came through and said, who will be eating first? Because there were two small children there. And I immediately said, well, I will be. And my thought was, well, I bought the tickets. And after all, I'm the one who should be, you know, taken care of first. It's where I was at that time in my life. And my wife immediately said, I'll wait. I'll feed the children first, and then if there's time, I'll eat. I didn't even understand that kind of logic. I just thought that was pretty stupid. You might not get to eat. And now I wouldn't even dream of letting my ego be the more dominant force in my life. It's just been a shift away from that. And this time of the statesman is when we begin to see that it is in serving others that we are able to grow. And ultimately, the fourth archetype that Jung talked about is called the archetype of the spirit. And this is when we finally get it, that this is not our home, and we are not these bodies. And none of this is real. It's just all illusion. It's all the world of the changing isn't who we are. There's a world beyond the world of the changing, the infinite world. Jung said, as he talked about this, that the telling question of your life is your relationship to the infinite. That's the telling question of your life. Do you indeed have a relationship with the infinite? And as you begin to understand this, you begin to see yourself as the witness to your life. You can step outside of your body. You can step outside of your possessions. You can let go of the ego, which is nothing more than the idea that you carry around, which says, I am what I have and what I do and what other people think of me. That's the ego at work. I am what I have. I am what I do. I am what others think of me. And separation from you, rather than connection to you, is the source of my life. I am separate. I am, my personality is different than yours. My body is different than yours. My possessions are mine. Whereas at the higher levels of consciousness, you see the connection. That's what mystical awareness is. So that when you come into that fourth and highest archetype, you are literally just sort of amused by your body and all of its demands. And the less attached you are to it and the less connected you are to it, the less influence it has over the decisions that you're making in your life. And that's when you get to the point of surrender. And when people say to me, well, your books have taken on this change, this shift, I've always written from my heart. And I've always spoken. I've sort of grown up before the microphones of America. I was doing it on The Tonight Show back in the 70s and with Merv Griffin and with Phil Donahue and on the Today Show and with Dinah Shore every week and John Davidson. You remember all of those? I mean, it was those were all things that, and I'd go out there and as I was changing, I would find my message changing. And I was writing for athletes and warriors because that's where I was. And I thought, if you're going to be one, you should be as effective an athlete and warrior as you can be. And so I go back and I reread Erroneous Zones, Pulling Your Own Strings, those books. And I think there's great messages in them. I'm not ashamed of them. But the emphasis in my life is different. And the books that I write now and the programs that I produce now and the talks that I give now come much more from having moved through those archetypes. And it was never a goal. It was never anything I said, well, you know, I'll start out here and I'll just be a pretty good athlete and I'll enjoy my body. And then And it isn't to say that at all times I feel like I'm this spiritually connected soul. I face the same kinds of struggles and difficulties that every one of you listening to this faces. But I always seem to be able to now come at it from a perspective of I'm not alone. It's that wonderful line in A Course in Miracles that says, if you knew who walked beside you at all times on this path that you have chosen, you could never experience fear or doubt again. And the key word there is if you knew, if you had that knowing, which means if you had no doubt whatsoever that you weren't alone, you would never be able to experience fear again or doubt again. And even when I say to myself, you know, can I pick up a microphone and talk for as many hours as we are scheduled to talk? And will I be able to have it come out in an intelligent way without repeating myself? And will it be entertaining? Will it be interesting? And so on. And then I just remind myself, I'm not alone up here. And I just go where I'm sent. And I just allow it to come through me. And I suggest that the people who are the best at virtually anything that they do have really moved into that area of surrender. Like, I don't think Michael Jordan, when he was dribbling down the court, was thinking about putting one foot in front of the other and what he was going to do with the ball when he got it. And when that person came up to him, which move he was going to make. There's a surrendering process. I mean, you make as much money as you can make, and you do it as well as you can, get yourself in the best shape that you can get in. All of those kinds of things that you do. And then, ultimately, you surrender. And you just allow yourself to flow in the way that instinctively you know how to flow. And there's that surrendering process that is difficult for so many people because they're so connected to their ego. There's such a strong belief that I really am what I have, what I do, and what other people think of me. And it's in the suspension of that ego. And I wrote a book. I spent a long time writing a book, writing every day for almost 2 years, called Your Sacred Self. And it was really my effort to take a very in-depth, hard look at this ego and ways to transcend it. And I don't mean transcend it by getting rid of it. I don't think you can ever get rid of your ego, as long as you're incarnated into a physical body, unless you really reach God consciousness. What I think is that you learn to tame it and not to make it the dominant force in your life. I always like Tagore's observation, who I wrote an essay, he picked as one of the 60 most powerful teachers in my life in a book called Wisdom of the Ages. 60 Days to Enlightenment, like 60 essays, 60 days. And Tagore was one. He said, I went out alone on my way to my tryst. But who is this me in the dark? I step aside to avoid his presence, but I escape him not. He makes the dust rise from the earth with his swagger. He adds his loud voice to every word I utter. He is my own little self, my Lord. He knows no shame. But I am ashamed to come to thy door in his company. The poets can say it so beautifully. I mean, that's really looking at this ego and how it just, wherever you go, it sort of makes the dust rise from the earth with its swagger. It adds its loud voice. It's constantly beckoning you to remember that if you don't get it first, somebody else is going to get it. And that person might be better looking than you. And that person may be making more money. It might have nicer clothes. Or might have... And the ego part of us is like, we go back to that athlete and back to that warrior, and you have to win. And then you get to a St. Francis or a Sister Bernadette or any of the great spirits who've walked before us. And you begin to see that they're not attached to any of that. They're free of that. And when you become free of the ego, you open it all up. And I think probably the thing that it takes to make yourself free of the ego more than anything else, to open yourself up to this world in which I'm going to be speaking here about a spiritual solution to every problem, is you have to really get your past clear. You have to get out of it. You have to get out of the wake. You know, the wake is the trail that is left behind, right? The wake doesn't drive the boat. It's just a trail that's left behind. It's an illusion to believe that the things that happened to you in your past are the reason why your life isn't working today. You can go to therapy for the rest of your life and analyze it and figure it all out, but it still all happened. And in a universe in which there's an intelligent system guiding every single aspect of it, every mosquito, every snail, all of the passageways inside of your body, and all of the glorious ways that the planets all align with each other, there's one force in the universe that's flowing through everything. But there's no mistakes in it. And I think for me, two things really happened that I really strongly urge you before you go any further, before we go any further here, is to really examine the wake of your life and to understand that it's just a trail that is left behind and to let it go and merge yourself into the present moment, which is where God is. God isn't going to be doing anything different an hour from now than God is doing now. And God isn't doing anything different right now than God was doing an hour ago. So that God is all there is now. Just now. And any time you are not here now, you are away from God. And any time you are away from being at peace, you have sent God out of your life. So connecting on a spiritual level, on an energy level, which I'll go into a great depth later, is really removing yourself from your past. I've written about this in a book a few years ago called You'll See It When You Believe It. But for me, the real turning point in my life came when I was able to finally, once and for all, practice this thing called forgiveness. I ended up as a young man, 34 years old, at my father's grave in 1974. He had been dead for 10 years. And it's interesting, I said I had my 60th birthday just a few months ago. And when I was sitting at the table with my whole family, which is a lot of tables, all 8 children and their girlfriends and boyfriends and spouses, and my mother was sitting alongside of me, who is 80, almost 85 years old. And she leaned over and she whispered something in my ear that I'll never forget. She said, 60 years ago, she said, I came home from the hospital 10 days after you were born. And when I walked into the apartment where we lived on Piper Street on the east side of Detroit, your father had left. And he had taken my jewelry and my mother's jewelry, your grandmother, and he had sold it. And he had left a note and moved in with another woman in Ann Arbor, about 45 miles from Detroit. And he left your brother Jim in charge of your brother Dave. Jim was 3 1/2. And Dave was 1 1/2 and very sick, very sick. And that's the scene she came home to in 1940. And she said, your father did not only this to me, but to 5 additional women in his life. And most of that I knew. And he never paid a penny in child support, and he never made a phone call. He never checked on his 3 boys ever in his life. He spent some years in prison, and ultimately died at the age of 49 in 1964 of cirrhosis of the liver. Now, you know what causes that. So I was placed in a series of foster homes and orphanages and so on until I was about 9 or 10. And my mother always had in her mind that she was going to get her family back together again. And she did in 1949. And she remarried my father in a different body. Because life gives exams, you see. It really does. It's like it's like school. You know, you go there, you take algebra, you don't pass it, you got to take it again. You know, and eventually you get it. Like, I don't want anything to do with algebra, or I got to really work on this algebra in order to make it work in my life and to understand it. And that's what you do. You either walk away from it, or you embrace it. And she still had lessons to learn, so she married another alcoholic, abusive person who didn't support and help out, and was divorced when I was 15. I spent most of my years between 12, 13, 14, and 15 riding my bicycle around the block, waiting for my stepfather to go out to the bar, because I didn't want to be there when, because he was, you know, there are pleasant drunks, and there are angry drunks, and he was an angry drunk. And I just didn't want to have to deal with that, so I just waited. We'd wait him out, or just wait till he'd pass out. So I spent a good part of my life wondering about my father particularly. Who was this guy who had three children who just walked away? How do you do that? How do you walk away from a woman, a good woman, a beautiful soul, with three children, with a depression going on in the world, and never make a phone call? How do you do it? I couldn't imagine being able to do such a thing. I would at least be checking up for me. But that wasn't my father's way. And so I would wake up in the middle of the night, and I'd be very angry. I'd be dreaming about meeting my father, and I'd be punching, I'd be hitting him. And I'd be, you know, like hitting him to a point where he'd be bleeding and kicking him in my dream. There was this kind of anger in me. And I'd wake up and I'd be in a sweat. And this was a constant recurring theme in my life as a young boy and as a young man in my 20s. And meantime, I was in relationships that weren't working. I was trying to write, but my writing wasn't working at the level I wanted it to work at. I was overweight. I was drinking. I was a candidate for a cardiac arrest the way I was living my life. And somehow, some way, some guidance came into my life, whatever it was, and I, through a series of just mystical experiences, which I've written about, and you'll see it when you believe it, I don't want to go into them now, I ended up at my father's grave in Biloxi, Mississippi. I got a phone call from a cousin named Dorothy Phillips who told me, I understand you've been looking for your father. And I had spent a lot of time in my 20s after I got out of the service looking for my father and then always giving up. I met a couple of his ex-wives and then I always just either ran out of money or I just had other things that I had to pursue and I would just abandon it. And she called, she said, I understand that you've looked for your father. She said, I just want to tell you that he died in 1964. This was 1974. And he died in New Orleans, and his body was shipped to the last town where he lived. He was a projectionist at the movie theater in Biloxi, Mississippi. And so his body was buried there at a pauper's grave. So I went to Biloxi, and I went to his grave, and I found his this little metal plate in the ground, a little marker that said Melvin Lyle Dyer, 1915-1964. And I was there, it was a Friday afternoon in August, and the experience was very, very powerful. I can remember it to this day. It was really transformative in my life. Because for the first hour or so that I was there, I just sort of swore. I was expressing my anger, my hatred, my bitterness, all of this stuff that I had carried around with me. And then something came over me. I was crying, I was sobbing, and I got very, very peaceful. And it was one of my first times when I felt that I had just made conscious contact with God. And I started talking to my Father in a different way. And I started saying, from this moment on, when I leave here, I'm going to send you love from now on. I don't know what made me say it or how it came about or whatever. And I did that, and I just walked away from there after 3 hours, put the little chain up on the across the driveway, because it's not really a cemetery, it's back of a hotel. And I never dreamt about my father again. And immediately after doing that exercise and just ridding myself of all of this hatred and sending myself, sending love where I was sending hate before, I went away and rented a place in Fort Lauderdale, Florida, and wrote Your Erroneous Zones in 14 days. And it was the easiest, sweetest writing I'd ever done up until that point. And I started running and exercising and changed my diet around. And I got out of the relationships that I was in that were not working. I began to take vitamins and supplements. My wife came into my life. All of these children. It was like a turning point in my life. There's a Chinese proverb that says, if you're going to pursue revenge, you'd better dig two graves. And of course, Mark Twain's famous line about forgiveness. Forgiveness is the fragrance that the violet sheds on the heel that has crushed it. On the heel that has crushed it. And I tell you this, and I say this to you, because not to elicit any sympathy, because in my way of looking at the world, and all of the writing that I have been doing this past quarter of a century, and particularly in the last year with the spiritual solution to every problem, I have come to a very serious awareness that everything in the wake had to happen, and the evidence for it is that it did. That's the evidence. And that's all the evidence you really need. And if you'll just stop for a moment, and this is a little weird, and I'll point it out. But in a universe which is endless, in which there is no such thing as time, in which there are no beginnings and no ends, and in which we are all infinite souls, there is an infinite number of times that we can be here. Incarnated in any number of ways, endlessly. I mean, when you think of no beginnings and no ends, that used to be one of the hardest things for me to do when I was a child. And it still is when I really contemplate it. The idea of being dead for a million years is not a problem. Is it for you? A million years? You say, all right, I can wait it out. I'll just be dead anyway. But forever? Like another million and another million and then 4 billion more, and you haven't even gotten started yet on how long you're going to be dead. The endlessness of it all, the infinity of it all, the no beginnings and no ends, the no boundaries of it all, is almost too startling to comprehend when we are coming from our egos, which have beginnings and ends. So that who's to say? Who's to say? Do you know who the most influential person in my life was? The person who has allowed me to come here and to speak about these things on these tapes and in this program? The person who has allowed me to write and express and experience the kinds of things that I've experienced and to grow in a spiritual dimension. You know who the most influential person in my life was? My father. This man who walked out when I was born. This man who had absolutely nothing to do with me, and the only reason I went to his grave was to find out if my name was on the death certificate. That's all I wanted to know. Did he even acknowledge in death that he had a son named Wayne? And he did. But who's to know that God and Melvin Lyle Dyer, before he incarnated in 1915, had a conversation. And God said to him, what do you want to do in this trip around? And he said, I'd like to teach one person forgiveness. So I'll go there and I'll just be an asshole. And that's what I'm signing up for. And there'll come a time when my youngest son will have to forgive me. And in the process of doing that, he will teach millions of others. Who knows? Who's to say? In a universe which, I mean, don't think that you understand it. Well, we had a little car going on Mars, which is like next door. It's just like the house next door in a endless universe. And we push a button, we wait 10 minutes, and this little car moves through these invisible signals through the universe, and we go, whoa, wow, look at how advanced we are. And Mars is like going moving an inch. And there's millions upon millions of galaxies and planets and trillions more of components that we don't even begin to comprehend. And I always feel that my conversation with God before I came here in 1940 went something like this, when God said, well, what do you want to do while you're here in this incarnation? What do you want to do? I said, well, I'll tell you what I want to do. I want to teach self-reliance. That's what I want to do. I want to teach people self-reliance, because that's really all I've ever done since I was a little boy. I've been doing it as long as I know, just in different formats, with different words, different audiences, and different ways of doing it, whether it's in writing or speaking or producing tapes or video or whatever. But that's all I've really ever done. And God said, you are sure? You want to teach self-reliance? I said, yeah. Well, then I think you better get your little ass into an orphanage. And I think you better spend about a decade or so there, and you've got to learn to rely on yourself. And once you have the conscious contact, the conscious direct experience of learning to rely upon yourself, you'll know it. And no matter who comes at you and tells you that what you're saying isn't true, you'll have a knowing. And you will never be able to be dissuaded from that. And that will make you a teacher. It's that conscious contact. And I think about your past and your wake and all of the stuff that's in it. And all of the people who were the most abusive. And I suggest to you that what Carolyn Mace talks about in her take, Why People Don't Heal, is really very simple. We don't heal because we bond to the wounds of our past. And we make our wounds our calling card. And our calling card can be, I am an incest survivor. I was sexually abused. I am the daughter of an alcoholic. I lived in the Depression. I survived a head-on collision. Whatever it might be. And we use this, and within 5 minutes of somebody meeting you, your calling card comes out in which you are bonded to your wounds. And you use these wounds as a way of generating attention towards yourself. And in the process of doing that, you keep yourself from healing and from moving into a spiritual dimension where you can literally bring the energy of spirit to the presence of any problem and dissipate it, nullify it, because it truly doesn't exist except in your mind. Do you know your past? Do you know where it is? It's only where you think. Do you know that every relationship you have, close your eyes, just close your eyes. Just close them. Okay, where's your husband? Where's your wife? Where are your children, your grandchildren? Where's your ex-spouse? They're all in your mind. Open your eyes. Now they're gone. Close your eyes. There they are again. They're just in your mind. You carry your relationships around in your mind. And if your thoughts about your relationships are on what is wrong, what you don't like, what you hate, what they did to you, that will be your experience. And you will materialize or manifest more and more of that pain into your life. If you look at what you love about them and make that the focus of your attention, that will be the nature of your relationship. It's the greatest secret in making any relationship work. It's so simple. Always focus on what you love. if you want that to expand in your life. When you look at someone that you're in a relationship with, look at what you love. Because what you think about is what expands. I'll be talking about that a little bit later on in much more depth. About not giving energy to the things you don't want. Because what you think about is what expands. And if what you're thinking about what you don't want, then more of what you don't want will just keep showing up. It's the only way it works. So now I'd suggest to everybody in this room and everybody listening that you take an eraser to all of the wounds of your past and you just send them away. And don't make them your calling card anymore. And bring the presence of God to those problems. And the presence of God is nothing more than a higher, faster energy. It's all energy. Everything is energy. It's the subject matter of a talk I'll be giving a little bit later here. Everything is energy. As Einstein said, nothing happens until something moves. And spiritual energy is just energy that moves very fast and at very high frequencies. And problematic energy is very slow and very low frequencies. And when high, fast frequencies are put in the face of low, slow energies, they are nullified. They dissipate. They can't survive. There's a song that they sing at a lot of the churches that I speak in. It says, surely the presence of God is in this place. It's a great affirmation. Anytime, or the affirmation from A Course in Miracles, I can choose peace rather than this. But surely the presence of God is in this place. Every time that I have a conflict with one of my children or with any place, I just bring that line to bear on what it is that I'm experiencing right now. I just bring that line to bear. Surely the presence. Because there's no place that God is not. As the little child in India in the 7th century, who was an avatar, who was really God in a human form, and everywhere he would go, people would be healed just by being in his presence. Just like St. Francis. He'd be seen in the village, he'd be seen in the valley at the same time. Lights would emanate from his body wherever he would go. And everyone in the village knew that this was a child of God. This was God in their village without the benefit of an ego. This was an egoless being who had shown up in their village. Which is what I believe our great spiritual teachers were. Like there's ways to reach highest levels of consciousness. One of them is to take on an ego and then spend a big hunk of your life seeing if you can shed as much of it as you can. Which has been my path. But there's another one where you just show up and you never take on an ego in the first place. There's only been a handful of those in recorded history. And this little child was one of them. And the elders in the tribe knew that this was God in a human form. And they went up to the little boy and they said to him, trying to bribe him, I'll give you an orange, they said, if you can tell me where God is. And the little boy, without hesitating, said, I'll give you two oranges if you can tell me where God isn't. It's one of the very fundamental precepts of this entire program is that there's only one power in the universe, and that is the power of God. And that power of God is good. And that whenever we see evil, it's nothing more than love going in the wrong direction, away from its source. And all we have to do is figure out a way to get it to turn around and start returning to its source. Because there's only one power in the universe. And that power is the power of good, the power of God. And every time we think that we are in something that isn't good, like a problem, like disorder, disharmony, disease, discomfort, what we've done is we've used our mind to create a separation from God. And as long as we are moving away from that source, from that spirit, as long as we're moving opposite of that, those problems continue to manifest. But if we can somehow figure out a way to turn around and move back in that direction, we can eliminate it. And I think my spending this first part of this presentation on the power and importance of forgiveness, I want to give you an example of how it worked, a real life example. I spoke in Amsterdam a few years ago, and there was a woman in the audience who apparently was very touched by what I had to say. And she found out about a year and a half or 2 years after I spoke there that her husband of 25 years had decided to divorce her. They had four children, and he left her for a younger woman, a woman in her 20s. And he just came home one day and announced that he didn't want to be married to her anymore, wasn't in love with her, and that he was leaving. And that was it. And you can imagine that that kind of news was devastating to her. And immediately she went into a deep depression. She was seeing a psychiatrist in Holland. And whenever she would talk about trying to resolve this or trying to come to some resolution of it in her mind, the only person that had ever made any impact on her was this guy, this American guy named Wayne Dyer. And she found herself taking Prozac. She found herself in a deep state of depression to a point where she was suicidal. In fact, she had even tried suicide. And she was not eating. She was losing weight. And she couldn't get it out of her mind. Four children, 25 years. In one day, all down the drain. Okay? And her psychiatrist had suggested to her, this is a true story, that if he was making no progress with her at all, and he suggested to her that if this American named Wayne Dyer was so influential to him, why don't you write to him, or better yet, go see him? And she said, the only thing I know is that he lives in a place called Florida. Now, those of you who are here or listening know, perhaps, that Florida is a state, and there are 19 million people who live there. I am one of them. She got on a plane and flew to Miami in a desperate state, rented a car, and drove north and checked into a hotel. Now, I'd like to just move the scene to a Sunday afternoon in my home in Boca Raton, Florida. I am preparing to give a talk the next day in Orlando to a group of teachers who teach middle school children. So I'm sitting at my dining room table, and I knew that I was flying out the next morning, going to Orlando, and from there I had to go to Anchorage, Alaska, and from Alaska I had to go on a book tour for this book I had written called Wisdom of the Ages. And I was preparing it, but while I was preparing it, I was reading a book that has always been very important and influential in my life. It was written by Carlos Castaneda, who was a great teacher in my life, who speaks of higher levels of consciousness with passion and reaching what he calls levels of impeccability in your life. And impeccability doesn't mean following the rules. It means being in that impeccable energy of God, being in that life space on a daily basis in which miracles become things that you perform, because impeccability is the transition from the ego to the spirit, where you become impeccable. And he wrote something that I jotted down. I noted, and I thought, boy, I'd really like to, this is so powerful, I'd really like to include this in my talk tomorrow. But I don't know how it relates to junior high school teachers, but meantime, that's never made much of a difference to me. I figure out a way. It's like the politicians who are being interviewed, you know, they've already got their answer. Ask any question you want. You know, how do I get from here to Lake Oswego? I want to tell you about my education program. That's exactly what it is. You know what I mean, right? So when you have the mic and the audience is there, you can sort of use any story that you want. But I didn't quite know how to make it all relevant and why I was even reading it, because I wanted to write about the little punching age and how to reach these kids and how to tap into their passion and not be judging it and not find fault with it, but to love them for their exuberance and for their joyfulness and for how silly they are and how easy it is to wrestle with them and to, you know, to have you know, just joyful times. They're just so cool. They're so dorky that they're cool, you know, and that's what they say about me. So the telephone rings, and it's a bookstore, Liberty's Bookstore, in Meisner Park, in Boca Raton. And they said, is this Dr. Wayne Dyer? I said, yes. Well, we have 25 copies of your brand new book, Wisdom of the Ages, here in hardcover. Would you be so kind as to come over and autograph them? Because I've done some book signings for this particular bookstore. And I said, well, I'm leaving tomorrow, and I'm going to be gone for about 3 weeks, so I wouldn't. There's just absolutely no time for me to get over there. And my wife is listening in the kitchen, and she said, honey, she said, that's Liberty's? She said, I'm supposed to pick the children up, the four children, the youngest one, are at the movies. And if you, they get picked up at 10:20. And Liberty's is right next door, and they're open till midnight. She said, why don't you just drive over there, pick up the children, and then run in and sign the books? And I said, that's a great idea. So I told the bookstore manager on the other end of the line, I'll come over tonight. I'm going to come over and pick up my children at 10:20. All right. So you can see there's a lot of things happening here, a lot of changes that are taking place. Phone calls, I'm reading something, I'm trying to figure out how to put all of this together. All of these things are called synchronicities by Carl Jung, and by those at lower levels of consciousness, they're called coincidences. But the word coincidence comes from the mathematical term coincide, and it means two angles that fit together perfectly are said to coincide. So we have taken a term that means two things that fit together perfectly and interpreted it to mean things that seem to fall together accidentally. It's what we do with our ego, because we just really can't get past the idea that because we don't know how to orchestrate these things and manifest these things and make them happen ourselves, and we are the very center of the universe, then there must not be any power greater than us that is allowing everything to collaborate with everything else in perfect harmony, synchronized to a term called synchronicity. It is all synchronized. It is all God's work. Okay. So I drive over to the movie theater, 10:20, pick up the children, drive over in front of the bookstore, park the car in a no parking zone. But I'm only going to be there for a few moments, and the car's running, and I've got the flasher going. And I say to the four children, don't drive off in my car. They're 10, 12, 14, and 15. So I run into the bookstore. There's a stack of books there. There's a pen. I'm signing away. And all of a sudden, this woman with a Dutch accent comes running into the bookstore, throws her arms around me, gives me a bear hug, and said, oh, my God, oh, my God, in this heavy, thick Dutch accent. It's really you. It's Wayne Dyer. I can't believe it's really you. I flew all the way here to see you. You know, she's all out of breath, and I said, oh, hold it, hold it, hold it. She said, you've got to say something to me. You've got to say something to me. And her heart was beating fast, and you could see that she was all excited. And I said, well, let go. And she sort of, oh, I'm very sorry. She was very proper, you know. I said, what? And she told me the whole story. 25 years of marriage, four children, depression, Prozac, suicide, eating disorder. She was very thin, a very attractive woman, but you could see that she was deeply pained. You could see it in her face. You could see it. And told me the whole story. And she said, And I flew to Miami. I rented a car. I checked into that hotel across the street. I decided that when I was here, because of the time zone difference, I wasn't that tired. I walked over. I saw a movie theater there. I went to the movie. I walked out of the movie theater. I saw the bookstore that's right next to the movie theater, and I thought, I know he's got a new book coming out. I wonder if it's out in English, because I could read it in English. So I walked into the bookstore, and you're standing there. And I flew to Florida to find you. Now, I often think if that phone hadn't rung, she might be in Jacksonville or something today, driving around looking like through the streets of Boston. You remember that song? On the MTA, yes, right. Yeah. So I said to her, I said, look, the strangest thing is that I was reading something this afternoon. And I didn't know why I was reading it, and I wanted to use it. I thought I wanted to use it in a talk I was giving tomorrow in Orlando, but that's not why I was reading it. I was reading it to give it to you. I said, I'd like you to go over to the cashier, get a pad of paper and a pen, and I'd like to tell you, because I had memorized it, what it is that this great teacher, Carlos Castaneda, had been told by his teacher, Don Juan Matus, and I'm going to give it to you. And she let go of me, but she was looking like trying to sneak away, thinking, if I walk three steps away, he's going to bolt for the car. I know it, huh? Because I'm just this crazy Dutch lady. I said, no. I really want to tell you this. Because I know. Because, see, I believe that all of this is orchestrated. There's no accidents. When people give me things to read, or when something like the St. Francis book that showed up, if you, that woman in the audience and handing me that, and what that meant to me, and the people that I took on this tour, which I'll tell you about later, all of this was all orchestrated in divine, absolute perfection. Even the falls, even the struggles. In the Kabbalah, it says that every fall of your life provides you with the energy to propel yourself to a higher place, that spiritual advances are preceded by falls, and that if you could just see that while it's happening, instead of waiting 10 years or so and then realizing that you had to go through that. And those falls can be accidents, and they can be breakups, and they can be fires, and they can be horrible as well. But there's always something there, because, and especially when you understand, and a lot of people ask the question, yes, but what about people who are dying? What about children who are starving? And Ram Dass once taught me, he said, all of the people in the world who are starving are part of the perfection of the universe. But so is your desire to end it, a part of that same perfection. Go with that. Go with that. If ending it is something that you see as your mission, then do that. Don't become one more person who just says, it shouldn't be happening. Isn't that terrible? And you become part of the problem, if you will, the illusion rather than the solution. So the woman came back and she had her pad of paper. And I said, this is what Castaneda said to me, for you, as you drove up here today to meet me. He said, and I paraphrase it here, he said, one day I finally realized that I no longer needed a personal history. And just like drinking, I gave it up. And that, and only that, has made all the difference. That's really very, very powerful. This idea that, Castaneda was told by his teacher, he said, you will not be at the level of impeccability until you can check into a motel, the seediest motel that you can find, with rats and cockroaches as your companions, and not come out of that room until it makes no difference to anybody outside that room, whether you do or don't. That's how long you got to stay in there. You have got to really let go of all of your attachments to everything and everyone that's in your past. All of it. And it doesn't mean being inconsiderate. It doesn't mean not being loving. It means that you merge yourself into the present moment. And any time there's something back here that interferes with your level of impeccability, you just bring a higher sense of awareness, a higher sense of consciousness to the presence of that anguish, angst, pain, whatever it might be, and allow it to dissipate. If you can right now, in this moment, just think of something that has happened to you in your past, which you have hung on to, which is painful. A relationship breakup, perhaps an abuse of some kind, an accident, the death of someone close to you, a fire. Anything at all that you can think of that has been tormenting you in your life. And just, like, get a vision of that. And then bring the presence of God to that. Just begin to see higher and higher consciousness, a faster frequency, in coming into that space, and watch as it dissipates. In your mind, it can't stay there. God cannot stay there with non-peace, because God is love. And he that dwelleth in love dwelleth in me, and I in him. It's just pure and simple. God is love. So you bring love to the presence of that. And you just constantly make that your habit until it no longer is something that immobilizes you. Now, people say, yes, but my past, I mean, I've got to understand it. I'm saying you have to get rid of it. But you can't get rid of it until you embrace it. If this little blue cap that I have in my hand is your past, okay? And I say to you, I want you to get rid of it. And it's right over here. Just hold your hand. Just hold that, all right? If I say, that's my past, and I want to get rid of my personal history. I just want to get rid of it. So how do I do that? Do I just say, okay, it's not here anymore? Mm-mm. I have to toss it out. I literally have to get rid of it. So how do I do that? I come over here, and I embrace it. And by embracing it, I understand it and accept it. And then I toss it. I can't toss it unless I embrace it. So I embrace it, take it, send it away. You don't just walk away from it. You throw it away. But you have to embrace it first. So you go into all of those things called the wake, and you just cleanse yourself of it. You clear it out. And in the clearing out process, it's gone. My teacher in my life, who died on the same day that I received my doctorate, on the 14th of June, 1970, as I walked across the stage at Cobo Hall in Detroit, Wayne State University, Dr. Wayne Dyer, big shot. And my teacher, in the same hour, passed away in Menlo Park, California, on the 14th of June, 1970. His name was Abraham Maslow. And Maslow was a great, powerful, profound influence in my life. I've written much about him. I dedicated one of my earlier books, The Sky's the Limit, to him. And what he taught me as a counselor, as a helping person, was this. That when you are working to help another human being, he said, always find the place within them in which they have had some success. Never let them dwell on the problem. Because by dwelling on the problem will continue to manifest and will continue to fester and will continue to be a force in their life because we become what we think about. So give them, if you're going to speak for an hour to them, give them 15 minutes to dwell on the problem, on all the things that are wrong, like, I can't get along with my mother. I can't overcome my addictions. I've been overweight all my life and I really want to lose weight. I'm compulsive, obsessive. I have an eating disorder. Whatever it is, I can't pass algebra that's in school. I can't get along with my wife, my husband, my children, whatever. That's the problem, okay? I have low self-esteem. I don't like myself. I keep attracting the wrong people into my life. I can't get ahead. I can't make any money. I'm always in debt. Whatever it might be. Let them present what it is that they consider to be the problem. And then shift after the first 15 minutes onto any evidence that you can find of their being successful at what it is that they think is a problem. I've been overweight my whole life. Was there ever a week in your whole life that you didn't overeat? Never. How about a day? Did you ever miss a meal? Did you ever eat only half a sandwich? Did you ever put the bread to the side? Whatever it is. Sometimes you got to really search because people really want their problems and they want to really present them to you and they want you to, because they want to purchase a friend. That's basically what they're coming to you for. And a friend is someone who says, oh, wow, well, you have really got some serious problems. And if you think yours are bad, just wait till you're done because I want to share mine, you know. If you think getting along with your mother was bad, wait till I tell you about mine, you know. How? And this is kind of the way. But a helping person, that is a person who is helping someone to not have problems, which is what this whole program is about, is someone who will put the attention, the focus, the energy on success, on what you can do rather than what you can't do, on any amount of success that you've ever had with it. And any addict will tell you that they've had weeks when they have been addiction-free. Smokers will say, yeah, I worked for a week. Let's go back to that week. Even with illnesses. If a person can take an illness in their life, and I'll talk more about this later here. If a person can take responsibility for their illness without guilt, without guilt, whatever it might be, whatever that experience might be, even if it's cancer, even if it's rheumatoid arthritis or heart disease or whatever it might be, if you can somehow say, it's mine, and I'm taking responsibility for it because I got it. I don't know how, I'm not sure what, but I'll take responsibility for it without any guilt. The moment that a person is willing to do that, then they also are saying, then I now have a voice in ridding myself of it. But as long as you are dealing with it from this perspective, that there's absolutely nothing that I can do about it, that I am trapped, then you're stuck. Because now you're waiting for whatever it is that might have caused it to change in order for you to get better. So that shifting, and Maslow's was always, find the greatness in a person. Find the saint, because the energy of the saints is in all of us. Find the saintliness in you. Find the godliness in you. Find the greatness in yourself. And put your attention on that. On when you have been successful, when you've been able to do something that really has worked. And as you do that, as you practice more and more of that, you begin to see that the line that I opened up here with, that you don't really have any problems. You only think you do. And this is why the Course says this. And this is the last part of what I want to say here at the beginning. You open up any scripture, any holy work. Take the Old Testament. And open up the Old Testament and read it. All right, I'll do it. I never have, but I'll read it. So you start out with Genesis. And I never got past the begats, to tell you the truth. As soon as it was somebody so big begat, so-and-so begat, so-and-so, and all the begats, they started losing me. Exodus was not even on the table any longer, all right? And then I would get past that and I would read a little bit, but that But I always got through those first seven or eight or ten chapters in Genesis. And the opening line in Genesis says, in the beginning, this is so crucial for everything you're going to hear. In the beginning, God created heaven and earth. Opening line. Line 31, Genesis 1, 31. 31 lines later. And all that God created was good. Was very good. Okay? So here we go. What a conundrum. What a paradox. How do we deal with it? If everything was created by God, and everything that God created was good, how do we explain anything that isn't good? How can we have anything that isn't good? How can we have evil? How can we have disorder? How can we have disharmony? How can we have poverty? How can we have illness? How can we have disease? How can it exist? And it's a real fundamental paradox to consider. But if you consider it in such a way that it was presented to me by some of the ancient teachers, whom I'll be speaking about a little bit later, and look at some of the principles, it becomes quite clear. If everything was created by God, and everything that God created was good, that includes you. If you're part of everything. So, what part of you has moved away from God? It's a belief or a thought, if you will, that I am separate from God, which is what the ego is, isn't it? I am what I have, I am what I do, I am what others think of me, I am my personality, I'm separate from you, I have a different body, I have a different personality, I have different stuff, and I'm separate from God. God is out there, and I'm here. I'm not connected to God. I'm separate from God. And in that separation, in that separation, in our minds and only in our minds, we create this idea that we're separate. And in our separation, we create in our minds these things that are not good, called problems. And we move into these very low and very slow frequencies of energy, which say, which are all based upon this idea that we're separate. So that we don't really have problems. We just think we do. And as we think we do, our bodies do not control our minds. Our minds control our bodies. And our bodies literally begin to react to what our minds have convinced ourselves is true. And so now we start feeling lousy. And we start having pains. And we start telling ourselves all kinds of things that literally aren't real, but they exist. Because reality is only God. And then we do the same thing collectively. We create in our minds whole large groups of people who also have similar minds, and we create on our planet all of these disorders called war, and all of these this hatred and bitterness, and it all comes from individualized and then collectivized thought. And all we have to do is bring the presence of God to these lower, slower thoughts, and we can dissipate them. Now, I told you earlier that I just returned from a pilgrimage, just last week. Took off on the 4th of October, flew to Rome with 24 people. From Rome, we took a bus to Perugia and to Assisi. In Assisi, I reconnected to St. Francis. It was my second visit. In the Portiuncula, the area where St. Francis did his started his whole order, the it still stands as it did in the 13th century. And when you walk into that place where St. Francis did his healings, you feel, I felt the energy. Because see, if there's no, again, as Einstein said, there's no such thing as time. If there's no such thing as time, there's only one force in the universe. That force is God. Everything is of God. Then that one force, with no time, that was in St. Francis is in you. Because it's everywhere at once. So that in a sense, when I wrote Wisdom of the Ages, I knew that I could connect to, in a heart space, in a heart sense, I could connect to every single one of those great teachers and great masters that I wrote an essay about in 60 Days to Enlightenment for you. I knew it. One of the Native American poets said, when we walk upon Mother Earth, we always plant our feet very carefully because we know the faces of our future generations are looking up at us from beneath the ground, and we never forget them. We never forget them. You know that you can connect to the same spirit that was in Shakespeare, or Rumi, or Omar Khayyam, or Buddha, or Jesus, or Mother Teresa, or Yeats, or Shelley, or Keats, or any of these great and powerful statesmen and stateswomen and philosophers and thinkers, Emily Dickinson, Elizabeth Barrett Browning, and Langston Hughes, and Patanjali, who I'll talk about later, that they aren't distant and separate from you because no one is. That unity consciousness, higher consciousness, is one in which you begin to see yourself as connected at all times. And that when I would look at a picture or a rendering or a sculpture or a drawing of one of those people, I would literally feel and ask them the question, what would you say? And I'd start writing and it would just come through. And it was like John Keats was writing through me, or Omar Khayyam, or Rumi. And that you can all do that because the same force that's in you was in every genius and every evil person that ever lived. There's only one force in all the universe, one power. And it's our belief in two powers that creates problems for us. From Assisi, we flew to Paris. And from Paris, we flew to a little town called Pau. And from Pau in France, we took a bus for 45 minutes. And we ended up in a little village in the Pyrenees Mountains called Lourdes, where in 1858, a young girl named Bernadette, 14 years old, the worst student in her class, the oldest of 9 children, very poor parents, went to a grotto and saw an apparition that she described. She went back home and she described this apparition in detail. And everyone thought the same thing that everyone thinks when people see apparitions. You're talking to dead people. You're talking to ghosts. Booga, booga, booga. There's something wrong with you. And she went back again. And this was between February and April or May of 1858 when she was 14 years old. There were 18 apparitions. 18 is an interesting number. To me, it's the most spiritual number in the universe. And I've said it since I was a little boy. One stands for the one power in the universe. And 8 is the symbol of infinity. One power, infinitely. 18. 1-8. The secret of the universe. And you'll find many, many, many things appearing in 18s. At any rate, there were 18 apparitions. And on the 14th apparition, I believe it was, all the townspeople came and they demanded, and the priests and all the people in the church, they just insisted that this young Bernadette identify this and describe what it was and command it to talk to them. because she was the only one that was seeing it. And so she did what she was told. And she commanded the apparition to talk, and it wouldn't talk. And finally she begged the apparition to speak, and the apparition said, "I am the Immaculate Conception." That was the only words that the apparition said to Sister Bernadette, Saint Bernadette. And the apparition pointed to her to go to a field and to dig with her hands. But the priests had demanded that she make the flowers bloom in the middle of winter in the Pyrenees, in February or March, whenever it was. And the apparition refused. Dig. And she went to this field, and she put her hands down into the mud, and she dug, and she dug, and she dug, and a spring came up of water. And a crippled man drank from the spring, and his crutches were thrown away, and he was healed instantly. And one other person was healed of a very, very serious disease. And so they began to think that this young girl was indeed seeing something, and there were 18 apparitions, and then they never appeared again. But the spring, when people would come and drink of the spring water, and by the way, the water, the spring water is still there today in Lourdes. It has never stopped. And you can go there and take as much of it as you want. We drank gallons of it while we were there. Now, the intriguing thing about this is Bernadette had to leave Lourdes at the age of 16 because everyone wanted to touch her. Because people were being healed miraculously by this apparition and this water. And so she left and she went into the north of France. And she died in 1878 at the age of 35. And in 1925, after 66 confirmed miracles of people who prayed to this girl, she was declared a saint by the Catholic Church. And so they dug up her body to move her body to a sanctified place, which they do of saints. And when they opened her casket, the body was incorrupt. It had not decomposed even one tiny bit. And they did a biopsy on her liver, and it was vital, as if she were alive. One of only 13 or 14 people in recorded history whose body never decomposed. There's a book about incorrupt bodies. And today, if you want to, you can go to the north of France, an hour and a half train ride from Paris, and you can see Saint Bernadette's body exactly as it was when she died at the age of 35. Still hasn't decomposed. Now, that's not why I'm telling you the story. At 9:15 at night, there is a procession in Lourdes. Every day, between approximately the first day of spring and the 1st of November, every year. And the people who are the ones who have the greatest seats of honor are the lame, who come to Lourdes. Well, the village has 17,000 people. Lourdes is the second most visited place in France after Paris. 5 million people visit Lourdes every summer from all over the world. Now, put this into context. Egypt, the entire country of Egypt, has less than 2 million visitors a year. 5 million people come to this little village. Many of them lame, many of them in wheelchairs, but many of them just people who want to drink the water and want to experience the peace, the tranquility, the spirit of this, the energy, if you will, of this beautiful place, which is what I wanted to do and why I asked these 24 people who signed up to go with my wife and I on this pilgrimage. And at 9:15 at night, listen to this. It's just, I hope I can give the proper credit with my words, because it's beyond words. In 60 years of living, I can honestly say to you, it's one of the top two or three moving experiences of my life. And while it was happening, I didn't want it to end. Now, I have been an official at graduation ceremonies where we get 300 graduates to try to just line up and get up on stage at the same time that their name is called. And we have to have four rehearsals for it, and invariably one goes the wrong way, and it's like the wrong name is being called, and people are putting the tassels on the wrong side, and it's endless if you've ever worked in schools.